versus Mongrio et al.
Good morning, Your Honor. May I reserve 2 minutes, please, for a rebuttal? May it please the Court, I am Conrad Key of Jackson Lewis PC on behalf of Guidance Residential. After a month-long trial in this case, the jury returned a special verdict in favor of Guidance. In favor of Guidance on its claim of trade secret misappropriation, including a specific finding that the respondents had engaged in a willful and malicious misappropriation of Guidance's trade secret. The jury made that determination after hearing extensive evidence that the defendants had stolen information from Guidance, lied about it in an affidavit submitted to the court, lied about it in their depositions, shredded documents, wiped the computer, all the while the litigation was pending. They heard and rejected the same arguments that the underlying defendants are making before this court. Notwithstanding the willful and malicious determination by the jury, after a 15-month delay in entering a judgment and after repeated pushes by Guidance that included a reference...
15 months post-verdict?
15 months post-verdict, Your Honor. And if you look at the record, you'll see several requests from Guidance for a status conference with the court regarding this motion, and ultimately the court did not rule until Guidance unfortunately had to go to the court and suggest that we were going to seek relief from mandamus to require the court to enter a ruling. And you'll notice that, you know, from an $848,000 judgment, the interest on that for 15 months that Guidance lost is very, very significant. I mean, it's well into the six figures. So when we take that into account, and I don't know why Judge Roberts delayed 15 months in entering judgment on a relatively easy issue, she declined to award Guidance exemplary damages without any discussion of the relevant factors. Now, we know that when we see here that there are nine factors here that the court is supposed to consider in determining this, a court should consider the deliberateness of the defendant's actions, defendant's good faith belief, the defendant's behavior, the defendant's size and condition, closeness of the case, the duration of the defendant's misconduct, and the presence of any remedial action, the defendant's motivation for harm, and the defendant's attempt to conceal his conduct. All of these factors, none of these factors have anything to do with Guidance. They all have to do with the folks that are defendants in this case. Now, when we look at this, what we'll see is when we look at some of the exhibits here, for example, we see lack of good faith. The court statements here, we've been very clear he should not retain using this confidential information. We see emails and exhibits and so forth. Here's, for example, Your Honor, is an affidavit that was submitted to the court. UIF does not have any knowledge regarding the contents of the book of business. This was an affidavit that was submitted to the court before Judge Roberts was in the case, and which clearly the defendants lied. And that they ultimately, when we came to trial, sort of fessed up to this. Now, when we come up to these factors, it's our view that the court's decision on this to deny after this 15-month delay was manifestly unreasonable. And again, we look right here at another affidavit. I want to be clear. I've not used Guidance Book of Business. I didn't copy any part of it. I deny these unsupported allegations. Now, later when we get into discovery, we find dozens of emails, all of which are entered before the court and are entered before the jury, which is why the jury ultimately came to this decision that this was willful and malicious. So it seems impossible to come up with a scenario in a civil trade secret case that could be more egregious in this case. It could be more compelling for exemplary damages, and particularly when we get the judge whose only factor that she discussed is a modest recovery. There's no discussion of any of these factors. So we would suggest to the court that there was a clear abuse of discretion and that the court...
So, I have a question about that. The real argument in the damage issue, there were two things: how much you lost per customer, and then how many customers you lost.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And where you really probably lost with the jury was they didn't think that you had proved the number of customers. The arithmetic seems to be that they accepted something less than half of the customers claimed.
I can come up with that as one scenario, Your Honor. I could come up with some other scenarios, but I know that's the scenario the defendants have come up.
Well, the numbers seem to work pretty well with that scenario.
They do, Your Honor.
There doesn't seem to be a scenario where they accepted your damage number as opposed to the one that works with the scenario I've described, because that would be fewer customers accepted because you had a bigger number.
We certainly had a bigger number, Your Honor.
So under either scenario, the jury was persuaded that something less than half of the sales claimed or lost. Sales isn't the right word. Loans claimed or lost.
That would appear to be the case, Your Honor. No, but that, however, does not have any relevance to the question of exemplary damages. It certainly doesn't have any relevance to the...
I understand that argument, but I'm just exploring when she says weak recovery, what that might mean.
And, Your Honor, I'm not convinced necessarily it's a weak recovery. But I think, turning to the next issue that we have here, we have an award of attorney's fees to the defendants in this case, on part of the case, which exceeded what their actual cost was. Now, we understand sort of the theories that are being presented before the court.
Is there any way we know those attorneys get the money rather than the opposing party just getting to pay a lesser amount to your client?
We don't, Your Honor, but the contract in this case says very clearly it uses the word incurred. It doesn't use a lodestar standard. Under the trade secret theory, of which the guidance was awarded its attorney's fees, the court's permitted to use a lodestar theory, and I'm sure the court's familiar with sort of that analysis. But when it came to the contract claim for the attorney's fees, that contract claim specifically used the word attorney's fees incurred. So that's exactly the concern, is here we have these folks who, A, get away by deliberately misleading the court, don't have to pay exemplary damages, and then on top of that, they get a windfall because they are actually getting money that they didn't incur, which is exactly what the concern is here. Turning to a couple of the other issues in this case, there's some question about whether the trade secret claim, there's this ownership issue versus possession. I would suggest that all the cases cited by the defendants to the court regarding possession are all cases involving a plaintiff, where the plaintiff is asserting they can assert a trade secret claim, and there seems to be some dispute as to whether or not the plaintiff merely possessed the trade secrets or whether they were owned the trade secrets. So, for example, if I was a contractor with Boeing and Boeing hired me to do something, I had an employee who took trade secrets from me, somebody might argue those are Boeing's trade secrets because Boeing hired me to do that. And courts have said I, as the company, can still pursue that claim against the former employee for theft of trade secrets, regardless of who is the ultimate owner. So there's simply no case out there that supports this proposition from the plaintiff that they have these documents in their hands, so therefore they somehow could use this. And on top of that, when we speak about the documents they have in the hands, we've never seen those things. They were never admitted to the court. Why weren't they admitted to the court? Because Mr. Hussein directed one of the witnesses to shred them, right? He directed to shred them, and another individual wiped his computer. So to suggest that you can somehow get benefited from this for documents that you destroy and don't admit it to the court seems ludicrous to us.
Was there a spoliation instruction to the jury?
There was not a spoliation instruction, Your Honor, under Washington law. That's a very difficult instruction. That was certainly an issue that we argued to the jury, the spoliation factors.
All right. Thank you.
Turn it off so you don't have his exhibit.
Well, it's a little bit offensive here.
I would.
May it please the court, Ivan Soner representing respondents, University Islamic Financial, Anwar Mangrio and Ejaz Hussein. And I do want to address some of the points that appellants raise, but what I want to initially focus on and use my time on is to direct the court's attention to the possession issue. not only because I think that that's really the issue that dictates a ruling in favor of respondents here, but because I think this is a critical issue that is not clear under Washington law. And this is an opportunity for the court to issue a clear ruling that will allow employees to understand what employers' rights are under the Trade Secret Act and how far an employer can reach into an employee's personal contact lists or personal information of any kind.
Was it ambiguous in this case? I mean, the contract seems to suggest they knew that they weren't supposed to be doing this and were hiding it.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, did you say the contract?
Conduct.
Oh, the conduct. Well, I think what...
Wiping computers clean, shredding...
I can address the... I'm sorry.
Lying about things? I mean, that suggests you knew you shouldn't be doing that.
Well, it certainly suggests that they were concerned that their employer was going to be coming after them. But what we're looking at here is a legal issue about possession. And, well, I guess I will address those issues first of all. We have an employee, Janae Iqbal, who was one of the employees who left University of Islamic Financial, then came back to Guidance Residential. He shredded his personal notebooks while he was a Guidance Residential employee. That's why those weren't available at trial. And I would also point to Omar Mahmoud, who was one of the salesmen, and I think counsel said that none of the personal lists were admitted at trial. Omar Mahmoud's personal lists were admitted at trial. That was Exhibit 347. The court can look at them and see what's on these employees' personal lists. And as far as the shredding issue, what that testimony was that this salesman would give copies of the list to his assistant and then say, shred these when you're done, because he didn't want tons of copies of these documents floating around. And I think that's a very sensible thing to say, and that's what he said at trial. In our industry, shredding is a good thing. We don't want lots of copies of these.
What's the story on the computer wiping?
I don't actually know what's being the computer wiping, I think, was one of the employees kept a copy on his or had a personal email account. And prior to the events in this case, he would periodically clean out his inbox. So he's deleting his inbox like everyone does. So the information wasn't there when the lawsuit actually got filed. There was no spoliation after the lawsuit was filed.
There was no cleaning of a disk per se.
No, there wasn't. And specifically, Guidance appellants requested a spoliation instruction, and that request was denied. There's no spoliation in this case. That's not really an issue. And because we're talking about possession here, and possession is a legal issue, it's not really the sort of details of the post-move conduct are less important. And what's important is what these lists were while the employees were employees of Guidance Residential. And under those circumstances, what was undisputed and what was clear was that these employees kept them on personal systems, personal computers, personal email programs, spiral notebooks, things of that nature that Guidance did not have access to and did not have possession of. And this possession rule that courts have developed subsequent to the passage of the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, that's the modern rule. You'll notice that a lot of the authority Guidance relies upon is like more than 100 years old, some of it. Since the passage of the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, courts have recognized that there's this tension under the Act about who has the right to assert ownership of a trade secret or to bring a claim under a trade secret. And the well-reasoned decisions have decided that, and the reason for that is because the Act says you can sue for misappropriation of the trade secret of another. But it doesn't say who can bring a suit. It doesn't say what interest you need to have to bring that suit. And what the courts, what the well-reasoned decisions have found, kind of led by this DTM decision out of the Fourth Circuit, is that possession.
But why should possession have to be physical possession?
It doesn't even have to be physical possession. Any sort.
Why shouldn't it be imputed by the employment relationship because the acts are being performed for the benefit of the employer?
Well, and that's where we're talking about this line drawing test, and that's where we're talking about, you know, how far does the Trade Secrets Act reach into an employee's kind of personal effects?
Well, do we care about whether it's something that's done within the scope of employment for which the employee is being compensated?
Well, here's the rule, I think, that comes out of these cases. The rule is that and if you look at the restatement, I think that this comes out as well, that if you have an employee who's actually hired to develop a class of information where their job is you know, where their job is inventing something and they're inventing it for the employer, or where their job is, you know, calling customers to develop a list that they're giving to the employer. Under those circumstances, you've got an argument that that information is
or a list that they're using for the employer.
Well, that
they're
is
using
where,
in their own work.
That is where we're on the other side of the line, Your Honor.
Well, the employer gets the benefit of the completed contract, don't they?
They absolutely do. And the employer got the benefit of that completed contract, and they also got the information about the customer that the salesman put into their system once the contract, once the employee applied for a mortgage.
How is the preparation of the list that the employer has paid the employee to create? I mean, there's lots of other duties, but that's part of what the employee is doing. How does that suddenly become something the employee is entitled to keep to the detriment of the employer who paid for its preparation?
And this is where we talk about the reach of the Trade Secrets Act. And what the DTM court said is what the Trade Secret Act is focused on is knowledge. You have to have knowledge of a trade secret in order to benefit from the act, in order to be able to disclose it to another if you want. If you don't have knowledge of a trade secret, you shouldn't be able to sue. And where an employer is the only one who has knowledge of that trade or that alleged trade secret, and the employer doesn't have it at all in the first place.
So the employer knows there's a black book with a list of all the customers, but he doesn't have a list. Is that enough information?
That is not enough information.
Why not?
Because the public policy aspect of this is that the burden should be on the employer under those circumstances. If an employee's
so if I'm the employer, if I make you get you the employee, give me a copy of the book every day, I'm protected. But if I just let you do your job with the book, I'm not protected.
That's right. If you care about your trade, you know, your customers, then you'll have the employee turn that list over to you. And what this goes back to is the terms of the Trade Secret Act, which says that you have to take reasonable measures to protect your trade secrets. And if you're leaving your trade secrets in the sole possession of your employee and not
I can't
even
trust my employee.
I think leaving your trade secrets in the sole possession of your employee and not bothering to get copies of them and not having the employee keep them on your system.
It sounds like the answer is yes. I can't trust my employee to protect my secrets. I've got to get a copy from him.
The employee
has every motivation.
You
develop a list and not communicate that list to their employer.
No, Your Honor, because the Trade Secret Act.
If you don't ask for it, you don't get it. It's mine.
I think that's right, because the Trade Secret Act is not designed to address every possible. It's not a catch-all industrial tort. That's what this court said in Stola. It's not designed to address every single instance of possible employee disloyalty. It's designed to address situations where a party actually has knowledge of an alleged secret and can actually.
What does the law favor, employee loyalty or distrust?
I think the inquiry is where the burden should lie and what the balance of interest is. Because
it sounds to me like what you're advocating means I should assume that I can't trust my employees.
But you can absolutely trust. I mean,
it doesn't sound like I can, because if I just trust them, I don't have any secrets. But if I don't trust them, I do have secrets.
You can't. Well, yes, if you just blindly trust your employees and don't ask them to sign.
Blindly, I interviewed them, I evaluated them, I hired them because I thought they were trustworthy, honorable people. I interviewed the people they'd worked for before. They told me the same thing.
And I would agree that under
but
those.
But I can't trust them, because if I trust them based on that field of information, I've got no secrets.
That's correct. So if Coca-Cola has a trade secret in its Coke formula, and it decides to turn that over to an employee of Coke and let him take it home and say, you know, and don't ask them for any sort of additional assurances. Don't have them sign a confidentiality contract. Do nothing. Let them keep it at their house. At that point, as a matter of law, Coke has not taken reasonable measures to protect that secret. And if the employee is developing the formula in their house and Coke knows about it and says, well, I won't worry about it. They can keep it in their basement. It's not a big deal because I feel like I can trust my employees. That, as a matter of law, is not reasonably protecting your trade secrets. These secrets were kept on spiral notebooks in employee home offices. Under those circumstances, as a matter of law, you can't have trade secret protection. That's what the court should rule in this case, and it should reverse the trial court.
This whole issue of these lists, Your Honor, is a red herring. Mr. Hussein testified in this case. He was a party in this case. He's the individual that directed these lists be shredded. Mr. Mangrio was a defendant in this case. He's the individual who testified that he had a computer, that this so-called list was on the computer. We never had the list in this trial because Mr. Mangrio testified that he had his computer wiped and he gave it to his son. And when he gave a computer to us later in litigation, later we find out that he's given us a computer that's all coming after the fact. What the defendant's essential argument here is that the guidance didn't take reasonable measures. Well, that's one of the elements of this case. That's one of the issues the jury was instructed on. That's one of the issues found against them. And this theory about possession is directly contradicted by well-established Washington law in Novogratzky, in which Novogratzky case.
So you're telling us the reasonable measure question's answer appears in the jury's verdict.
It is, Your Honor.
Because they were given the definition of a trade secret, and that was one of the elements.
And that was one of the arguments made by the defendants that was rejected by the jury. And Novogratzky talks about a memory issue where an employee has a memory. Now, they didn't bother to write it down. And the court in Novogratzky says it can still be a trade secret. We have the same issue in Boeing where the defendant in that case had worked up some windows.
Pre-act cases.
I don't believe Novogratzky is a pre-act case, Your Honor. I think the Boeing case might be. But I believe Novogratzky postdates, but I'd have to double check that. I believe it is. The other final issue, Your Honor, Novogratzky specifically references the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, so it's a post-act case. When we come to the final issue, Your Honor, it's just very clear here that the defendants lied to the court, that they did, and they've been able to, they've gotten a windfall from this attorney's fees provision, and they've got a windfall from the court declining to impose exemplary damages without considering the relevant factors. We would ask the court remand the issue and direct the court below to enter exemplary damages and to adjust the attorney's fees to the amount incurred.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank
we'll
you.
Be
can I cited the record, but I incorrectly cited that Omar Mahmoud's list was 347. It's actually Exhibit 266.
266. So,
correct.
Thank you very much. We'll be at recess.
All right.
Yeah.